And thank you for that opportunity for an administrative adjustment. Our first case this morning is United States against Blazier. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. Chief Judge Efron, honorable judges, may it please the court. We're here because the appellant in this case was denied the opportunity to test the accuracy, the integrity, and the veracity of the urine testing samples that came from Brooks Laboratory that were used to convict him at his court-martial. The granted issue really breaks down into two kind of sub-issues here today. Number one, it involves both of the urine analysis reports that were admitted before the trial, and that they were now considered testimonial hearsay, and that the expert was allowed to testify as to the contents of the testimonial hearsay without the analyst being subjected to cross-examination.
So is it your view then that the cross-examination of Dr. Papa didn't meet the Crawford-Melendez standards?
Yes, Your Honor.
And why not? He's the certifying official. His declaration, and point out what was wrong with the cross-examination of him.
He was the certifying official for just the cover memorandum that accompanied the drug testing reports when they were transmitted to the base legal office. He was not involved with the testing, so he was not involved with any of the declarations that were contained in the two documents as the testing was being conducted.
That doesn't appear to be the defense counsel's perspective in the cross-examination, which is quite lengthy and gets into every aspect of the testing.
Defense counsel was tied, his hands were tied as far as cross-examination before the members as when it came to the military judge's ruling. When it came to his cross-examination during the motion hearing, he did highlight certain perspectives to the military judge through his cross that would make Crawford applicable in this situation. For example, he talked about what the lab analysts are aware of, that they're generally aware in 95% of the cases in GCMS confirmation testing that they will be reported as positive. He also highlighted the overall purpose of the lab, which is really kind of an interesting nugget from Dr. Papa. He was asked, what is the primary purpose of the lab? And he said it was to produce forensically defensible results that could be used in a legal proceeding. So these results that are coming from the lab have that primary purpose of use in a legal proceeding, which includes a court-martial. And he admitted in a follow-up question, and this appears on page 35 of the joint appendix, prosecution? Yes. So the analysts that are down at the lab are making these declarations and these statements in these two particular documents. And there are some examples, particularly because they're handwritten. These are not things that are just generated by the machines.
Did the defense counsel at trial tell the military judge which particular parts of the document contained testimonial statements for which there was no testifying witness?
The trial defense counsel did not highlight specific portions of the two records that were available to him. However, when you do a review of these records, there are some handwritten statements that clearly link the appellant's Social Security number to the laboratory accession number, therefore making it an identifiable person as far as with the sample, and a statement by the analyst making that this sample for this Social Security number, i.e. this particular person, was positive. And that was a declaration on the part of that analyst making that.
Why shouldn't it be a minimal requirement of a objection under Crawford and Melendez to have the objecting party identify the specific statement that's regarded to be testimonial in nature?
Possibly is an objection that should be here from here on perspective, but at the time of trial, he was objecting to the report in its entirety as being testimonial hearsay. And when you take and have to drill down and look at how these reports are generated, the information in these reports are generated, while there is some information that comes from just the machines and the computers conducting the analysis, which are not pages that defense counsel specifically highlighted, there is human involvement in that process. And the human involvement in the process is where the Supreme Court in Melendez-Diaz tends to touch on the errors that can occur.
Well, in Melendez-Diaz, the Supreme Court noted that it was not going to require calling every analyst now, everybody who participated in the process, excuse me. So where do we draw the line in terms of who the objecting party has to identify as a potential witness?
The objecting party should have to identify the person, the people who are making declarations that are contained in the packages. And there are various individuals at various steps making such declarations in these two particular packages that were used at appellant's trial. For example, on page 318 of the joint appendix, there is a document that contains appellant's social security number, the LAN, a handwritten annotation noting that it was positive for the components of the ecstasy as well as methamphetamines and amphetamines. And at the bottom of the page, there's a certification that is signed by one of the quality control officials and laboratory certifying officials at Brooks Lab. So that is just one example throughout these documents of where the appellant should be asking to bring these particular people who are making these certifications and these attestations of the accuracy of the testing. This goes to addressing the Supreme Court's footnote about chain of custody and the accuracy of the testing machines.
To understand the scope of where you're headed, if your view of the law is correct, can you tell us by name who should have been or should be called in this context by right?
There are quite a few names, so just to not belabor the court, going person by person. For example,
but to be clear, it is your view that the following people, he would have a constitutional right to have appear at his trial?
Yes, Your Honor.
And for example, who are those people and what are they?
For example, again, turning the court's attention to page 318, we have Ms. There's no more identifying data, so I don't know if it's a Ms. or Mr., but Constantina Zacharias was a laboratory certifying official who was signed the certification about the accuracy of the reports and the processes at the lab. Another example.
Did that certifying official do more than certify the lab, or did they actually conduct the test? Are they the analyst, or what are they?
He's not an analyst that conducted the actual testing himself. However, he is one of the lab certifying officials who conducted a review of the data.
What does he provide that Dr. Papa does not provide?
He provides a review, a more contemporaneous review rather than stepping back, as far as he's also involved with the actual signing off on the process that this was a positive urinalysis, where Dr. Papa was not involved with that particular review process for these samples.
Please continue. May have a list of 73 people. How long is your list?
I do not have a counting of names. However, there is in the joint appendix. And let me get the actual page. Pages 478 of the joint appendix and page 480, these were appellate exhibits of people involved with the specimens that would highlight particular individuals appellant would be entitled to call.
If your view of the law is the prevailing view.
Correct, Your Honor.
Counsel, you mentioned the certifying official. Isn't that just the type of official that in other cases the defense has objected to having present the testimony when the certifying official didn't conduct the test themselves, himself or herself?
And that is one of the core issues here.
Well, then how could the judge figure out who the defense felt was the subject of the confrontation requirement when we can't even identify them here today?
Well, we can identify them here today by going through it.
You just mentioned one individual who is an individual who you then said you probably would have objected to if that was the only person who testified.
That was a statement where I misspoke, Your Honor.
I may have misunderstood your point then.
The point that I was making with reference to that was that this was an individual who should have been brought in for appellant to be able to have the opportunity to confront him and the quality control review and the laboratory certifying official review and the certification that particular individual provided because they were involved with the actual review of the sample, not something just preparing in advance of trial.
Did the certifying official touch the sample?
It's unclear from this particular record.
Well, why don't we just go on the record that we have? What record did the defense make here as to whether the certifying official touched it or not?
What was drawn out in this record and in the motion hearing was the roles of the laboratory certifying officials and how they are involved with the review process and how these results are reported out as far as whether it's a positive urinalysis, which was where the concern is that these are being reported out and being used to establish a fact to prove a necessary element at trial. So that's where they're involved with this particular piece of the process and making a declaration on their own. I just would like to also briefly lay out the second sub-issue as it pertains to the granted issue in this case, and this really focuses in on the second urinalysis report from 10 July.
Counsel, before you get to the second urinalysis report, the first urinalysis was a random urinalysis testing, is that correct?
Yes, Your Honor.
In your view, what is the purpose of the random urinalysis test?
The purpose of the random urinalysis test at the very beginning is to ensure good order and discipline.
So do you think that it is or would it be or not be a true statement that the random urinalysis test is intended to produce forensically defensible results for the military to use in legal proceedings?
To answer your question, Your Honor, I think it does, and there's a point where the tenor of the testing changes, not necessarily the first immunoassay screening that is conducted, because at that point there is nothing to suspect that there's going to need to be a forensically defensible result. However, once it's pulled as presumptive positive and is sent to the rescreen and the GCMS, at that point then we're looking at proving the fact that this urine does in fact contain a concentration of a particular substance, and that's really truly then where it fits in squarely, within the lab's purposes of a forensically defensible result.
Leaving aside the lab's purposes, do you agree that the purpose of the military in sending all of the tests to the drug lab is as much for a deterrent purpose as for any other purpose?
And that is the stated purpose of the overall program as recognized by the Department of Defense, yes, Your Honor.
Do you think that makes a difference in terms of our analysis with respect to the first test as compared to the second test?
Yes, Your Honor, due to the fact that the second test was obtained at law enforcement behest.
So would you agree that the first test fits more comfortably within a business record exception in terms of it was not submitted or intended for prosecution purposes when it was submitted by the military to the drug lab?
At the time it was submitted to the military, no, Your Honor, but as said before, I believe the tenor of that got changed when they did the confirmation testing.
Well, when we look at the second test, what you are focusing on is what the military's purpose was when it sent it to the lab, right?
Yes, Your Honor, for that particular sample.
So why wouldn't we look at that same point of view with respect to the first test?
The difference between the two tests is with that second year analysis, when we're looking at the overall purpose, it's because then at that point the initial immunoassay would also be included within those testimonial statements because they are searching for a particular evidence. Whereas with the first test, when it was the random urinalysis and it went through the initial immunoassay, there was nothing at that point in time of the first screening.
I guess maybe a better way to put my question is do you think that it's more important for us to look at the purpose of the military in submitting the test or the purpose of what happened at some point in time at the lab? Which is more relevant in terms of whether it was submitted for a law enforcement purpose or not?
I say from the perspective of the appellant, it's difficult to separate the two because they're both very important in determining the testimonial statements. And I think it would be breaking it down based on having to break out what was the basis of the test when it went down, like Your Honor said, the overall purpose, but then also taking a look at breaking down the purpose of the statements once they're actually at the lab. So it's a balancing of both purposes and both intents to answer that question.
Counsel. Have you had a chance to examine the Seventh Circuit decision in U.S. v. Turner, which the government proffered as a supplemental citation yesterday?
I was not served with the supplemental citation. However, I have had the opportunity to review
Turner. Read the case?
Yes, Your Honor.
Would you comment on it?
Turner itself, and if bear with me, I would like to get
sure.
The opinion.
Thank you.
I do see that my time is almost up, so if I may...
You'll have an opportunity to answer the question as needed.
As far as with Turner in the Seventh Circuit, there is a very large key distinction here. Obviously, one, at appellant's trial, the inadmissible testimonial hearsay was admitted. So that's one key distinction with the analysis. Number two, the Seventh Circuit seems to focus, if I remember correctly, on the fact that these were machines and how active of a role did these particular did the particular expert that testified play. And is it our particular case, in the facts of our case, Dr. Papa had no active role in the reviewing and the actual handling and the certification of the positive result.
In other words, what you're saying is you're distinguishing it on the ground that the guy who testified in Turner had a hands-on role.
Yes, that's one area.
And Papa didn't, although he was a certifier.
Yes, Your Honor. He basically certified the paperwork that was the file as it was admitted at trial was assembled for the purposes of litigation, i.e. a litigation package, versus documents that had been prepared previously at the laboratory.
And you imply there's another distinction.
If, with the permission of the Court and Your Honor, what I'd like to do is review Turner again
in
once
rebuttal.
More and answer that a little bit more in depth in rebuttal.
I have two Judge brief Baker. Questions. Do you have a view whether this Court should or should not wait until Briscoe is decided before we decide this case?
I think what happened yesterday with the Supreme Court with the vacate and remand is what we're basically asking the Court to do here today is to take a look at the previous decisions applying Crawford and forensic testing in light of Melendez-Diaz.
And on your 478 to 79 list of people, do they all qualify in your view? All qualify in your view within Justice Thomas's concurring opinion?
There are a couple.
And if so, why?
There are a couple of individuals who do not qualify within these as far as the people who are poor, the aliquots, because that would not fall within Justice Thomas's screening. But for example, Dr. Lubeck is one of the individuals who was on page 478, who was involved with the confirmation of the testing. He's a certified chemist that was basically analyzing the data. He would be Ms. Hubbs, who in quality control, again, that same thing where she is actively involved in certifying the data, making a statement as to its accuracy. And again, I apologize. To go through each and every person, unless the Court would want me to do that.
Are you distinguishing between whether they're confirmation quality control results reporting, or are you being more particular and going into the record and figuring out what they actually did?
More particular because Dr. Papa testified about their general roles, and so taking marrying his testimony about the general roles with what is highlighted in the particular litigation packets to say, okay, this is what their process was. The people that would be excluded from the bringing them in for confrontation there again are those folks who are in specimen control, basically unwrapping the packages, the ones that are pouring the aliquot from the sample bottle into the testing tube. Those are the types of examples of type of people who are not required, but the people actually running the GCMS, running the immunoassay, doing the certifications and the quality control would be.
Do you read Justice Thomas's concurrence as being limited to certain named types of statements, which is what he seems to be saying, or do you read it some other way?
He seems to be highlighting particular areas where he says are what he considers to be the prior testimony.
Doesn't he seem to be cautioning the majority or the plurality that while I'm concurring in the result, my understanding is that it's limited to 1, 2, 3, 4.
And he does delineate
and 1, 2, 3, 4 are testimonial, and that's as far as I go. Or do you read it some other way?
I think the opening there is to take a look at, use these as the, as kind of as the courts have applied it, use these as a baseline. These are the four that I'm naming specifically. And if you have something that's analogous to these four, then that will qualify as a testimonial hearsay.
Has any court held that it is testimonial hearsay to have the person who's involved in quality control or confirmation that they have to appear as opposed to the person who actually performs the test?
Not not specifically on those grounds, but in State v. Caulfield, which was cited in our brief and is also highlighted by the Supreme Court in footnote 11 of Melendez-Diaz, they talk about these types of reports being testimonial hearsay and needing to satisfy the confrontation clause with the individuals that are performing these types of analysis.
You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Counsel for the government.
Good morning, Judge Efron, members of the court. May it please the court, Colonel Cordova and I have the privilege of representing the United States Air Force. The military judge correctly admitted appellant's random and consent drug testing reports on the basis of Crawford and Maggiari, and the Air Force Corps came to the same Crawford conclusion. I have three main points I'd like to cover with you this morning, if I may. First, Melendez-Diaz did not overrule Maggiari. Melendez-Diaz is easily distinguishable from this case, both factually and legally. Second, the Fourth Circuit's Washington case and the Seventh Circuit's Turner case published 2 weeks ago supports the position taken by the United States. Third, and finally, the point I would like to get to is under the facts of this case and the state of the law at the time of trial and now, appellant's drug testing reports are non-testimonial documents that are properly admissible.
So your position is that Dr. Pappas would not have needed to testify in this case?
No, Your Honor. It's certainly interesting that he did, in fact, turn out to be the expert from Brooks who did testify, but we don't think it was legally necessary that he do so.
So you're going beyond actually the facts of this case and saying that that's not necessary when the drug testing package is sent to a court-martial?
That's correct, Your Honor. Under the basis of Crawford and this court in Maggiari, that is indeed our position. It is certainly interesting that he did, in fact, participate in the test and also served as the expert, but we don't think it was legally necessary under the law for him to...
What's the government's response to the Briscoe remand? Because there, the Virginia Supreme Court held that the statements were not testimonial, and the case was remanded for further consideration by that court in view of Melendez-Diaz, which seems to indicate that the Supreme Court is looking for a different result.
Well, Your Honor, I'm not terribly familiar with Briscoe versus Virginia, other than to know Virginia passed a notice and demand statute, essentially putting the burden upon the defense counsel to identify or to call the witnesses, I guess, in support of the prosecution's exhibit.
Which indicates that the testimony is required.
Well, it may indicate that they want to see how the lower court will handle it and apply Melendez versus Diaz.
Yes, Your Honor.
But
I think there are
the question is, do we wait or not then?
I don't think that that
if
issue...
Not, why not? And if so, why so?
I don't think that issue is before this court. We're not under any kind of notice and demand statute, no burden upon the defense. The government did what the government has done under the law for many years, and therefore we don't think the outcome of this case is any way going to be determined by the outcome of Briscoe versus Virginia.
Counsel, you mentioned the Turner case. Could you explain further what the relationship of Turner is to the case before us in terms of what specifically was at issue in Turner?
When it was issued?
No, what was at issue in Turner in terms of the testimonial evidence?
Yes, Your Honor. As I understand, Turner, it was a supervisory expert from the lab who did not participate in the drug testing, but rather supervised those who did, to include a chemist who had prepared a report. That original chemist was unavailable for trial, and so the supervisory chemist came forward and testified at trial, relied upon the drug testing results to include the chemist who participated in the examination, and formed his own conclusion that, in fact, the substance in question was indeed cocaine. And the fact that he did not personally participate did not matter to the Seventh Circuit.
Is that a distinct... he didn't participate in the testing.
Yes, Your Honor.
The Seventh Circuit seems to be saying that despite the fact that he didn't participate and despite the fact that he relied on the records, the results of she who did, that somehow he formed an independent conclusion, therefore that we don't need to bring in she who did.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is that a distinction without a difference, or why?
I think that it is, because Dr. Papa did the same thing here, Your Honor. Dr. Papa testified about each and every page of the drug testing report, what it meant, described the entire testing process, and then he was asked to...
Well, that's not really what I'm asking. I'm asking whether, in light of Melendez-Diaz, can you draw the kind of line the Seventh Circuit seems to have drawn, which is, he's a hands-off guy. The hands-on person is gone, can't testify, or isn't proffered. But by reviewing the results, somehow that gets rid of the confrontation problem. By reviewing the results, and him showing up, that's okay. Now, let me ask you the same question you asked earlier in this context. Would he have had to show up in Turner?
The one who did?
Yeah.
Somebody had to show up, but he specifically would not be required.
Okay. Somebody had to show up, unlike this case, where you said nobody had to show up. Didn't you say that?
No, Your Honor. What we've done in the military, in the Air Force in particular, is we've always produced an expert so that confrontation can be satisfied, and as was clearly demonstrated in this case, we produce the expert, we produce the drug testing report, and by doing so, we completely avoid the problems in Melendez-Diaz. Melendez-Diaz, as you recall, was that bare-bones affidavit that we don't have in this case.
Can you define expert full stop, or expert with what relationship to the testing?
I'm not quite sure I follow your question,
Your Honor. Could you have somebody from Washington show up at all the trials and discuss the various testing mechanisms, rather than someone from Brooks' lab where the material was actually tested? You just said expert.
Well, yes, Your Honor.
Any expert do?
The normal rules for expert qualification will always apply, and that's something that the court's always going to have to determine.
For confrontation purposes, you're saying just any old expert will do as long as they're qualified as an expert. It need not be an expert who actually has some relationship to the testing.
Well, I think that goes to their qualification. They've got to have some relationship to the testing. They've got to be knowledgeable about
the actual testing of the particular sample.
Oh, no, they don't have to lay hands on it. No, just the overall process. And that's because the Air Force lab tests hundreds and thousands of these specimens each and every year. And they do so the same way every time. There's no specific identification of a suspect or no targeting of anybody. And that's why that anonymous routine testing takes it outside the realm of...
Well, how do you deal with the appellant's argument that even with respect to the first unit sweep test, there came a time when it was confirmed twice in a batch of one?
Your Honor, we reject that assertion, and we reject it based on the processes that the drug lab employs. It's those quality control specimens, the blind samples. Frankly, as well established in the record and in Macchiari, the testing analysts don't know if they're even testing a real specimen or a quality control specimen or a blind quality sample. They just do the same thing each and every time with what may or may not be an actual military member specimen. And therefore, they whether it's the initial test, the second test, or the third test, they have no idea that anything they're doing is going to bear testimony someday in a criminal trial. Just like we saw in Magliari, the exact same analysis applies here.
Isn't the government trying, it seems to me the government is trying to avoid Melendez-Diaz by slicing and dicing what the lab does so many ways that nobody's responsible for anything. We've got machines, we've got kind of low-grade technicians, they do the same thing mechanically all the time, nobody knows anything, so we don't have to proffer any, nobody has to testify because nobody knows anything.
No.
How far do we take that?
Your Honor, we've got to produce a qualified expert, which was done in this case. Dr. Pop, of course, was from the lab.
No, I don't deny his expert qualification. Let's assume that.
Yes, Your Honor, but he's as part of that expert, he was required to know the entire testing process, each step. He was required to be able to explain to the members every single page of that drug testing report. And in doing so, we're satisfying the confrontation clause because the trial defense counsel was afforded two full, very vigorous opportunities to cross-examine Dr. Papa, first for 29 pages before the judge on the motion, and then for more than 100 pages in front of the members. Cross-examination was well performed here. There was no confrontation problem as a result, Your Honor.
counsel in Turner, the court noted that the underlying lab report data charts were not introduced into evidence.
Yes, Your Honor.
That the evidence was the testimony of Block, the witness, as to his analysis of what the substance was based upon the information that he reviewed. Where in this record would we look to see testimony from Dr. Papa as to his analysis as to what the substance was that was introduced into evidence here?
Yes, Your Honor. He testified.
I'm not talking about the places where he testified about what others did and the quality of their work. Where is his independent conclusion as to the nature of the substance?
Let me have just a moment, Your Honor.
That's all they had in Turner. They didn't have any lab reports there.
Correct, Your Honor. At Joint Appendix 148 and 161, Dr. Papa, based on his education, training, background, experience, opined that the results of his two drug tests were forensically and scientifically reliable and showed the presence of ecstasy, methamphetamine, and marijuana, respectively. I think it's clear in the record that he did, in fact, rely upon the testing that was conducted, as reflected in the reports, and came to that conclusion as a qualified expert witness.
So your view is the testimony is he's testifying independently as to what the substance was, as opposed to testifying as an expert as to the quality of the test that others performed?
Well, Your Honor, I think he actually ended up doing both. But I think that's what makes the parallel to the Turner case. Yes, there is a distinction because the report wasn't actually submitted in Turner. But to borrow a phrase from Judge Stickley's question, that is a distinction without a difference because that's exactly what happened in Turner. The expert reviewed the test, described the test, and came to a conclusion that the substance in question
contained. Well, didn't the Seventh Circuit in the Moon case specifically say that they weren't going to let the analyst testify about the conclusions of others?
Yes, Your Honor. They did state that in Moon.
Okay.
Yes, Your Honor.
Now, in terms of testimony by experts, there's a division among the circuits as to whether there's a confrontation problem when an expert testifies about the test performed by others. The Second Circuit, for example, in the Mejia case, I think that's how you pronounce it, said that, said allowing a prosecution witness simply to parrot out-of-court testimony statements directly to the jury in the guise of an expert opinion would provide an end run around Crawford. And there appear to be at least three state Supreme Courts, or four, including the District of Columbia Court of Appeals, that have come to the same conclusion. What's the government's position as to whether an expert can testify about the test performed by others and then get that information about the test results into the evidence as a matter of fact?
Yes, Your Honor, we believe that this court has already answered that question in Magyari because that's exactly what happened. And that was a post-Crawford case. This court has already applied Crawford, and frankly, that's all Melendez-Diaz is an application of Crawford. It's not a new rule. It's nothing that's changed Crawford.
Did we say in Magyari it was the expert's testimony that was admissible, or was it the lab report itself under the circumstances?
Your Honor, I don't recall if the court actually defined or described it that precisely. But what did happen in Magyari is there was an expert, there was an admissible drug testing report, the same that we saw in this case.
Counsel, after the initial screening where a sample would test presumptively positive, what happens next?
As reflected in the testimony, it goes to another screening process where it's tested for a second screening, if you will. And if it's positive there, it goes on to the GCMS confirmation testing.
And at those two points in time, is there any purpose for those tests other than to produce evidence for trial? I mean, I understand they need to confirm that the substance is what they suspect it to be, but the problem is, on the one hand, we have the fact that in the military there's a unique drug testing system in place that isn't by its terms for a law enforcement purpose, right?
Yes, Your Honor, that's absolutely correct.
But on the other hand, it appears that language in Melendez-Diaz doesn't care about that. They care about whether or not at a point in time the purpose of the testing is for a law enforcement purpose.
Well, we take this outside the realm of law enforcement purpose, regardless of whether it's random or consent, Your Honor. And maybe I'm not addressing your question, but we don't believe there is a law enforcement aspect and that that's well established in the record. Dr. Papa clearly described how law enforcement has no role in what happens at the lab, and that's the relevant inquiry, what happens at the lab. The manner in which a specimen is collected, frankly, isn't relevant for Sixth Amendment purposes.
Well, I understand if the point that you're making is the one made in your brief that the lab people are not themselves members of law enforcement,
yes,
your point is well taken. But once it gets past the first screening, don't they understand that it's because the first screening was positive that they're doing the additional screenings?
Well, Your Honor, no, because again, they're forced to follow the same protocols each and every time. They're forced to test what they know, but can't tell you which one is a blind quality control specimen. They can't say specimen X is a member specimen that tested positive on the first screen, on the second screen, and even the third screen. Even the LCO can't do that because they don't find out until months later whether it was a blind quality control specimen or a real specimen.
But leaving aside the blind quality control specimens, which I understand they need to do to ensure that their equipment is correct and that their procedures are correct, the vast majority of samples that test negative at the first immunoassay test do not continue on to second or third test.
That's correct. They're destroyed. If they test negative at any step, they're destroyed. But again, if no member of the lab can say that's a member specimen that I'm testing, it takes it outside the realm of a law enforcement test.
And isn't it the overall purpose of the thing?
Now
you're back to where I said first. You're slicing and dicing it in such a way that nobody has any responsibility for everything and anything. You can just wash your hands of the thing.
No, you're saying
because this technician doesn't know, therefore it doesn't have a law enforcement purpose. Come on.
No, Your Honor, it's not a question of washing.
You got a bunch of stuff here that's 95% positive, and what are we swishing it around for?
Your Honor, it's not a question of washing anybody's hands here. It's a question of whether or not this was a search for evidence, or whether or not, as is clearly articulated by the judge's findings and is supported by the Department of Defense directives, drug testing in the military is for good or evil discipline. It's for military readiness. It's not for a search for evidence. And that's what's taking it outside the realm of Sixth Amendment.
Are all the tests that are reconfirmed on subtest 2 and subtest 3, putting aside the quality control ones, are all the other ones that are test positive submitted for purposes of prosecution?
Oh, no, Your Honor, not at all. In fact, many positive member tests don't result in a criminal prosecution. Many of them are, because the lab, they don't know if a member had a medical prescription that might have explained the result. They don't know if they were acting as a law enforcement informant.
Is lawful excuse the only basis on which a positive would not be submitted for the purposes of prosecution?
No. A commander's decision not to pursue a judicial proceeding would certainly take it outside the realm of a criminal trial as well.
If all that's true, why is it not relevant that on let's say you're completely correct, but on August 16th, the August 16th document is clearly created in anticipation of prosecution. Correct?
The August 16th.
You have the June test and the July tests. But on August 16th, we have the drug testing report.
Oh, the
clearly,
top
that, yeah, clearly yes, that's intended for the purpose of prosecution.
At that point, there has been a decision to go forward to trial, but that's a business records document, Your Honor, to which the defense had absolutely no objection in this case. They waived a business records objection here.
Putting aside waiver, why isn't everything that is a potentially declarative, certifiable, or Crawfordish in that document putting aside June and July, subject to cross-examination?
Well, we rely upon Crawford, we rely upon Magyari, which told us it is not, Your Honor.
But here we have this document which says this is law enforcement. I'm not talking about June or July. I'm saying this August 16th document.
Signed by Dr. Papa.
And the results reporting assistant. Why isn't everything on this document subject to cross-examination? Now, you can debate whether Papa is the right guy to cross-examine.
Yes, Your
but
Honor.
I'm asking a different question, which is, if I can find a person on this document, why don't I have a right to cross-examine them?
Well, Your Honor,
a person either in fact or behind the scenes.
We view the cover page, if you will, it's a business records document. It even refers to, in the course of, kept in the regular course of business, it talks about the records custodian. And once again, that was never an objection in this case, and therefore, we don't think it was improper for the judge to have admitted that page, or frankly, none of the machine-generated pages that were following it. And that, after all, is what was at stake here, were machine-generated results, not the results generated by any lab technician, as we stated in our brief.
Counsel, we have splits among the circuits, among the states, on this very issue. What is your view as to how this court should view those splits in light of the fact that few, if any, have been discussed either by defense counsel or by government counsel in their briefs?
Well, Your Honor, we rely heavily upon the fact that we're talking about the Department of Defense Drug Testing Laboratory. We're not talking about a state crime lab that is clearly seen in the other cases. Cases where a known suspect, like there's a spectrum of case law with Melendez-Diaz and Harker on one end, Magyari and, in our view, Blazier now on the permissible end of the Sixth Amendment spectrum. On the Melendez-Diaz end and the Harker end, we had known suspects in the context of an arrest. Where their evidence was seized from the person, and the police sends it to a state crime lab saying, please confirm that this is in fact the cocaine that we think it is. It's not routine, it's not objective, it's specific testing, and therefore it's very different than what you see in the Department of Defense Drug Testing Laboratory, where the purpose is explicitly for good order and discipline, military readiness. That's the purpose of what the lab does. And when you focus on what the lab does, which is what we should do because we're talking about the lab's documents, that's non-testimonial, and therefore I would distinguish any of those cases like Melendez-Diaz and Harkrow or any other case that's clearly criminal evidence in nature. We're not talking about criminal evidence here in drug testing by the Department of Defense.
But once the drug testing package is requested by the local installation,
yes, Your Honor,
that drug testing package is requested for use in a court-martial.
It is, but the focus still remains on what did the drug testing laboratory do, because that's the evidence we're submitting.
But,
we're not submitting how it was collected.
But the drug testing package contains all of that evidence. And now, correct me if I'm wrong, your argument is that because of the business records exception, all of that it's non-testimonial.
That page one of the document, but my point, as we stated in our brief, though, is those machine-generated results are pieces of paper that follow page one. They're not business records. Well, they are business records, but they're clearly not testimonial. They were produced at the time of the drug test.
Well, are we getting to a point where technology has given us a situation where individuals are not involved and defendants are not going to be able to cross-examine anyone because only machines are involved?
Well, you raise a fair point, Your Honor, but how can the defense counsel be allowed to cross-examine a GCNS machine? That's just not going to happen.
But there has to be human input into the machine and human oversight of the machine people who are certifying the documents.
But all the human involvement is just to make sure that the machines are turned on, they're working correctly, and that they are reporting accurate results. The members of that lab are not independently determining whether or not there is drug in a particular urine specimen. The machine is doing that. The machine is not a declarant. As the Washington court noted, another DOD drug lab case, the machine cannot be a declarant. There cannot be hearsay. You can't cross-examine the machine, and therefore there's no Sixth Amendment problem.
To what degree are you relying on the business records exception in this case?
Well, frankly, only if there's a concern, to get over any concern as to page one of the document.
Just for page one.
That's it, because the rest are
non-testimony.
They're made contemporaneously with the drug test. They're not made with a view towards a criminal trial, because, again, nobody at that lab knows until like 2 months afterwards whether it was a real specimen or whether it was a blind quality control specimen that produced a positive result. At the time, they have no idea that they're doing anything that is going to bear testimony against a specific individual in a criminal trial at some point in the future.
Is that the test? Is that the test that it has to be known as a specific individual, or can it be known that it might be used in a criminal proceeding?
I may be overstating it a bit, Your Honor. That's a fair point.
In other words, if, and I know you're not conceding this, everybody knew at the confirmatory test that there was a high likelihood that the results would produce a criminal trial, that would be a different situation, wouldn't it?
A high likelihood, but I would not concede that point.
Okay.
Because they just don't know until months later whether they even tested a real human being, a real military member specimen or not. So how could they have a high likelihood belief that this was a military member specimen who just tested positive and I may be going to trial? They can't have that belief under the facts of the record.
But with respect to the first part of your last statement, that it was a military member that had tested positive, they would have a high likelihood to believe that, wouldn't they?
I'm sorry, I didn't quite follow you.
You said that they wouldn't have a high likelihood to believe that it was a military member who tested positive and was going to a criminal trial. I'll grant you the second portion of the test, but with respect of the sentence, but with respect to the first portion of the sentence, given that other than the double blind tests, it means that there's a high likelihood that the test was positive at the first immunoassay test, right?
Well, there was a positive result, but whether or not it was for an actual military member would be completely unknown to the lab member at that point.
Well, who else do they test besides military members?
Well, it's the quality control specimens. Those are not actual specimens submitted under the DOD.
Other than the quality control specimens, who else's urine specimens do they test?
That's it, Your Honor, but that's a very significant point because it affects their expectation, their understanding about whether or not they're bearing testimony under Crawford. That's a huge point, Your Honor.
My other question is, you I think I heard you say earlier that the purpose of the laboratory was to ensure it was to aid in good order and discipline or deterrence and not to serve a criminal function at all. Is that what you said?
That's correct, ma'am. Yes, Your Honor.
I mean, I understand that it is true that that's the purpose of the urinalysis, the drug screening program from DOD, right?
That's correctly stated out, as stated in the DOD directives and instructions that we put in our brief.
But how does that impact the purpose of the lab, which I don't think you would disagree that it also, when warranted, that the urinalysis that it takes that test positive or other tests that it do, that it does it test positive, will be used for a law enforcement purpose, maybe used for a law enforcement purpose.
Well, it's a highly regulated laboratory. They're strictly governed by their DOD directives, the Air Force instruction. They're bound by that. So I guess I'm not seeing how they are taking.
Does the instruction say right on the face of it that one of the outcomes can be a criminal proceeding?
Could you repeat the question?
Doesn't the instruction stay right on the face of it, both the DOD instruction and the Air Force instruction, that that military justice proceedings are one of the outcomes?
They are one of the possible outcomes,
right.
But it's not the primary purpose. The judge found so, and we believe if you read all the directives, all the instructions, it's clear it's about preventing drug abuse. It's about deterring drug abuse. It's about ensuring good order and discipline and military readiness. That is the purpose of the drug testing laboratory. It's not to search for
evidence. Does the military keep statistics on how many of the positive tests result in prosecution versus some other action?
I believe those figures must exist, Your Honor. They're not.
They're obviously not in this record.
Right. I don't believe they exist.
Do you happen to know what they reflect?
I do not, Your Honor. I do not. What was your question? How many?
Well, you've posited the notion that that person who's doing the confirmation test really doesn't know whether it's a quality control test or sample, or whether it's a sample headed toward a court-martial. But I'm wondering if there's another category, which is a positive sample heading to non-judicial punishment or no punishment or a meritorious service medal or whatever. But
without a doubt, Your Honor, I know that there are statistics available. We've seen them in some other cases that have been sent up to this very court for consideration. They're just not in this particular record. And that's a fair point, because there are other
resolutions. It's not a point, it's a question, but I...
No, Your Honor, I don't mean to suggest you're making a point, but it's a point I would make, is that there are other alternatives short of a criminal trial as a result of a positive drug test, non-judicial punishment being one, administrative discharge being another. Treatment is called for as well, Your Honor, in the DOD directives and instructions.
And where in Crawford does it make that? Do those factors make it non-testimonial when there's knowledge that you're at the confirmatory stage of a test that can lead to a criminal prosecution? Where in Crawford does it become non-testimonial simply because there are other possible outlets other than a criminal proceeding?
It's a factor for an appellate court to consider, okay. Your Honor.
Thank you. Would you like to conclude?
Briefly, if I may, Your Honor. This is an extremely important issue, obviously, for both this appellant and the United States Air Force. We are convinced the military judge correctly admitted the appellant's random and consent drug testing reports. We are convinced that the confrontation clause was satisfied by the very vigorous cross-examination that took place in this case. Many, many airmen over the years have been properly convicted in drug testing cases on the basis of drug testing reports and expert testimony, as was seen here. And the confrontation clause has not been violated. Melendez-Diaz didn't change anything. The current state of the law shows that the military judge correctly applied the law to the facts that were before him, and we respectfully ask that this court affirm the decision of the Air Force Court of Criminal Appeals. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor.
I'd like to briefly start by following up with Judge Stuckey's question with respect to Turner and its applicability in this case. I know it's been discussed at length. One of the things the Seventh Circuit did rely on was the fact that the instrument readouts were not statements and that they were just machine-generated documents. However, I'd like to turn this court's attention to a very specific example in these drug testing packets, which demonstrate that there was human involvement and declarations and statements. And that occurs on page 365 of the joint appendix, where there's a handwritten annotation on one of the charts from the GCMS showing that the run was unacceptable. This was a declaration from the analyst conducting the test that goes beyond just a mere printout, which the Seventh Circuit seems to talk about. The Seventh Circuit also says that they saw no problem with the testimony, especially in the light of the fact that the initial analyst summaries, which contained some testimony or statements, were not admitted into evidence. And another distinguishing factor from Turner is that this particular expert that did testify was a lab supervisor whose job was to personally check and verify the results. And that was not the case with Dr. Papa and his testimony in this particular case. If we were to rely on this broad proposition that all we have is just the machine statements, then when is ever an accused entitled to confront the person who possibly made the mistake that led to the generation of those particular documents and to the certification of these results as positive?
Is that an issue in this case? Is this case about precluding the defense from engaging in discovery and confronting any person in the lab who may have made a mistake in the process?
That's one factor in this case, yes, Your Honor. While there's nothing to indicate that there were individualized mistakes.
Is there anything, if we ruled in favor of the government? would that preclude the defense in a future case from engaging in discovery, ascertaining whether there were problems in the lab, and requiring the presence and opportunity to cross-examine as a hostile witness any of the lab personnel who were involved in that process?
I don't think there's nothing to preclude that, and I think that's kind of the argument that was advanced in Briscoe a little bit when talking about the notice and demand and how that would all play out in the process behind it.
In Briscoe, there was no Dr. Papa. There was nobody testifying as to their independent view as to the nature of the substance that was at issue, like Dr. Papa testified to on page 164 of the record here.
Now, Dr. Papa did testify briefly, just that summarized statement where he did say that I found these results to be sound and that here's the substance. The difference between Dr. Papa's testimony and what it appears the other cases address is, like the government highlighted, his testimony is completely intertwined with the statements that occur in the drug testing reports that are admitted because he did go painstakingly page by page by page. So he never testified really what went into his own independent analysis other than this brief conclusory statement.
Isn't that what happened in Turner? That is, Block didn't test any of those items himself, did he? Didn't he rely on the tests that were performed by others?
He relied on the test, but what's not entirely clear from the opinion is how much he went into describing for the fact finder the particular analysis that he used to reach that conclusion, which Dr. Pappas did not do in this case. Another final point to make is the government continues to rely on the fact that these are kind of blind samples. However, there is testimony in the record from Dr. Papa that occurred during the motions hearing that the documents that record the land and the social security number of the individual to follow the aliquots from testing, and particularly the document that I'm pointing to this court's attention in reference to this, for example, is at page 336 of the joint appendix. If you take a look at that particular page, it's a chain of custody document that, again, contains testimonial statements because it has handwritten notes in there about the drug level that it's positive for, and it contains a handwritten note as to the concentration level of the particular drugs that it's positive for. But if you look at that document, the land number is pre-printed on it, as well as appellant's full social security number. And that's definitely a distinguishing factor from Maggiore, which, as this court noted, was limited to its facts. We are in a situation with this case that Maggiore kind of left open is these same reports that were non-testimonial hearsay in Maggiore could potentially now have walked through the door to become testimonial hearsay, and that's appellant's position before this court.
Does Maggiore survive Melendez?
I'm sorry, Your Honor?
Does Maggiore survive Melendez-Diaz?
I think when you take a look at Melendez-Diaz, there are some ways the majority can survive Melendez-Diaz in Maggiore because Maggiore was definitely limited to its facts. So Melendez-Diaz is basically defining and clarifying the Crawford analysis. So
that's what it said.
So that there are ways, yes, that it can survive. Pending no further questions, I see that my time is up.
Thank you, counsel. We thank both counsel for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until 10:40 a.m.
All rise.